This is recorded on the morning of July the 23rd, 1970, at 1607 Western Drive, West Lafayette, Indiana. It is an interview with Dean Helen Schliemann, retired, Dean of Women, Purdue University, and our vehicles of the Department of History. This is for the use of the Purdue University Archives. Dean Schliemann, supposing we start out with the usual question. Give us your background, where you were born, where educated, elementary and secondary school, college, and then your interest in women and education, and take us up to the time of your first coming to Purdue.
I'm a Hoosier, first of all. I was born in Francisville, Indiana. Lived there with my family until I was 10 years old when we moved to Valparaiso. I started elementary school, fifth grade in Valparaiso, and went through high school. Then I went to Northwestern University, where I received an AB degree with majors in English literature.
Why Northwestern?
I don't think I have any very good reason, excepting it was relatively near to home. It was easy to get to from Valparaiso.
Of course, Chicago is closer.
I don't really have any very good reason for having chosen Northwestern. I don't think people got very much guidance in selecting a college in those days. But at any rate, I did finish my work at Northwestern for an AB degree.
And in what year?
1924. I had majors in both English literature and philosophy at that point. There had been no vocational counseling of any kind, and I assumed I would just go ahead living as I always had without any real preparation for a work life of any kind. I liked physical education very much. I liked the activity. And I decided then to go to Wellesley for their graduate course in hygiene and physical education, which was a two-year course at that time, and which had graduated most of the outstanding women directors of physical education for women in the colleges and universities of the country at that point. So I went there in the fall of 1924 and did get the certificate of hygiene and physical education in 1926. At that time, Wellesley was not giving a master's degree for the completion of the work that was necessary for a certificate. There was additional work required, and within the next 2 years I completed that additional work and did get a Master of Science degree from Wellesley College. My first job was a teaching job as an instructor of physical education at Ohio State University. I was there for 6 years and decided by then that probably physical education was not my field permanently. I did not teach then for the next year. I was home in Valparaiso, and during that year I worked with my father and brother in various business enterprises. And I was also finishing a book on the teaching of group golf, because this was at the time that golf was just beginning to be a very popular game for a great many people. It had always been a rich man's game up to this point, but we were beginning to teach it in groups, and there needed to be some methods worked out for group instruction. So although I have done a book on golf, it's on group golf instruction, which is quite different from being able to play golf, as you would understand. Then I operated the Forest Park Golf Course in Valparaiso during the summer of 1933. And in the fall, in late September, early October, as a matter of fact, I came down to Purdue as a graduate student, decided I better get back into education, and did a master's degree in psychology and education at Purdue.
Then you have two masters.
Mm-hmm, in quite different fields.
Yes.
And during the year that I was here as a graduate student, the first women's residence hall was built. And in the summer of 1934, I was given the job of being the director of the first women's residence hall. This was a joint appointment of the Dean of Women and the Chief Business Officer of the university. But it was definitely a joint appointment, and I was responsible to the business officer for the financial management.
Is this Robert Arby?
Yes, this is Arby.
And who was the Dean of Women?
Dorothy Stratton.
Dorothy Stratton.
And I was responsible to Arby for the business management and to Dorothy Stratton for the social and educational programs of the hall.
You just kept on from there?
Kept on from there.
All right, now what happened? We've got you up to 35. All right, now what?
Well, the residence hall program developed as we went along, and by 1942, there were three halls.
With how many women?
Oh, roughly 125 in South Hall, which is now Dumy, and another 150 in North Hall, which is now Shealy, and another 150 in West Hall, which is now Wood Hall.
How many at Purdue altogether?
Well, when I first came to Purdue in 33, there were about 450 women out of a total population of 67,000, I suppose.
A little smaller than that, probably.
Could have been.
Yes.
Could have been.
How does that compare to today?
Well, that's lots more than today. Lots more than today.
How many thousand women are here now?
8,000, roughly.
From 400 to 8,000. In a sense, that's the story of
what
you had to do, is to adjust to that.
That's the story, really, of the development of Purdue, in terms of students, certainly.
Well, let's go back to this in the sense of career. Did you go into government service during the war?
Well, in December of 1942, I went into the Coast Guard Women's Reserve.
SPAR.
The SPARs. And at this time, Dorothy Stratton, Dean of Women, had gone into the Navy in the summer. And along in the fall, the Navy had asked the Coast Guard, which operates under the Navy, of course, in wartime, or did at that point, to form a women's reserve. And they asked then Dorothy Stratton to take charge of really organizing a women's reserve for the Coast Guard. So since we had worked together at Purdue, she called me and asked me if I could come, and if I was going to come at all, I'd better come right then, because this was when I was needed. So I did decide to go, and thought I should.
What was your position at the time you left?
Well, Dorothy Stratton was the only officer in the Coast Guard Women's Reserve.
No, I mean at Purdue.
I was then still director of the residence halls for women.
Your title then was director.
Director of residence halls for women.
Yes.
So I went into the Women's Reserve of the Coast Guard as the second officer in, went in as the executive officer with the rank of lieutenant. And our job then was to recruit, in some manner, women for the reserve of the Women's Coast Guard. And we simply sat down at a desk and thought of all the women we knew that might and should probably come into military service at that point, and tried to get them in. So I was with the Coast Guard then.
Were you stationed in Washington?
All the time. Mm-hmm. 1300 E Street, that beautiful building. Right down downtown Washington. stayed there then until the summer of 1946. Dorothy left the Coast Guard in January of that year, and I finished my tour of duty as director of the Women's Reserve and helped in the demobilization.
What were you, a four-striper or three-striper?
Four.
The captain?
Right.
All right. Then you came back to Purdue.
Then I came back to Purdue.
And what was your title then?
Well, I came back as director of the residence halls for women and was back in the residence halls for a year. And during that year, I was asked to become dean of women and did accept that position.
And you were dean of women from 1946 until?
1968.
All right. Now let's get down to the tough one. Your staff, I know, and been here during those years, was considerably augmented with the growth of students. How many did you have on your staff in 46?
Well, at that time, the Office of the Dean of Women also did the placement for women students, graduating seniors. So we had a person in charge of placement, and we had an assistant dean of women. And that was it. We got another assistant fairly soon, but it was relatively small staff.
And when you retired?
Well, mercy, I can't remember. Seems to me there were 8 full-time staff at that point, and we did not do the placement. It did not, as did no other staff that I know of, multiply quite as rapidly as the number of students involved.
Well, let's get down now to, with thousands of women instead of hundreds. Will you talk about the let's put it in a nice way, not changes, but the evolution of your job of Dean of Women at Purdue?
Well, I think the job changed with the times, let's put it that way, as much as anything. And I think the Office of the Dean of Women at Purdue, as long as I have known anything about it, certainly during Dorothy Stratton's regime, so to speak, and all the time I was there, I think our special interest and emphasis has always been on the education of women.
You mean not just the classroom education?
No, I mean the total education of women.
Very good. Now, how did you do it?
Well, we were interested. This is sort of hard to explain. It seems to me that there's a factor in the education of women that is not present in the education of men, and that is that everybody has to keep trying to assure and reassure and impress young women with the fact that their education is important. Now, boys and young men know this. They know that they're expected to get as good an education as they can, to get as good a job as they can, and make as big a contribution to society as they can. But young women do not know this, even yet. They assume. A great many of them, even now, even though with women's liberation active and all the changes that have taken place, there are still an awful lot of young women who assume that they will marry and live happily ever after, period. They do not know that they are probably going to have to work outside their homes for pay, and they don't know that they're going to want to work outside of their homes. And this is a part of it that's different. And this, the total education of women, you have to put the emphasis not only on the outside the classroom education, but on the classroom education as far as women are concerned.
Well, how did you do it?
Well, for the past 15, 18 years, we have operate a freshman conference program, which started out as an individual conference program because we could do it with the few women that we had, relatively few, over a year's time. We could invite every single woman into the office for an individual conference and talk with her about her educational plans. This went from an individual conference to two people, to three people, to four people, to now, in the last few years, it has been a small group conference of four or five freshman women with one pretty highly selected upperclass woman, senior, and one staff member for a one-hour conference in the office. This was preceded by one meeting of all freshman women during the orientation period. And again, this is an interesting thing. The question was always, why in the world do you need a meeting of freshman women separate from freshman men? And the reason was, of course, because someplace someone needed the opportunity to try to tell women students what was happening in terms of women in the United States, in terms of their employment, in terms of the variety of their employment, in terms of the outlook as to what they probably would be expected to do in later life. In other words, they needed to know what the status of women was in the United States.
And they have you noticed a great shift, though, in what they are interested in? Say, take the freshman girl coming in after World War II. And when you left, is there a great deal of interest in what they're interested in?
Yes, I think there is. I think it's much more established now that they need to prepare themselves for a career, if you will, or for work outside the home, professional work, than there was before. Because I remember well the women students of, well, immediately after the war, let's say, the leaders among the women students and the women's student organizations who said, we believe we can make the biggest contribution to our country simply by being good wives and mothers and good family women. Now, I don't think you find women saying this, young women saying this these days. They expect, they know they have to be good family women, good wives and mothers, but they also know that more is expected of them. Most of them, we hope.
Yes. I remember my first teaching was at a girls' junior college that emphasized the education of the individual girl, but that was usually in such refined things as theater and to do parlor recitations and so forth. That sort of thing has gone out, hasn't it?
I think it has. I'd like to go back to something that I know you were interested in. That's the liberal science curriculum, which was started at Purdue back in the late 30s.
It had a wonderful director, and let's go on the tape and say this, and Mrs. Babcock, who had an idea that was, I think, ahead of its time. You were interested in liberal science, I was, and may I say for the record that Dean W. L. Ayers destroyed every piece of paper relating to those wonderful women and girls, destroyed it in my presence. The record of their achievements was not kept purposely by the dean. I shall say no more than this, that his inability to support the program and his refusal to, in the terms of staff and of, shall we say, financial encouragement, was why the liberal science program was discontinued.
Well, I suppose, for the record, because there'll be some people that don't even know that the liberal science curriculum was set up for highly selected freshman women who were recruited for this particular curriculum because of their high intelligence and wide interests and range of interests.
May I go off the tape?
Yes.
All right, we're back on the tape now. Liberal science was made for brilliant women and for women who had intellectual curiosity, who did not wish to become specialists, let's say, in biology. They would, say, concentrate in literature. But the course was designed to encourage young women to think and to talk in small groups and to study very, very hard.
Well, one can't help wondering what would have been the final outcome if the liberal science curriculum could have continued and could have expanded. It was ahead of its time, there's no doubt about it. But if we had, in this country now, great numbers of women who had the kind of background in science that that provided, we might not be in the difficulties that we're in terms of our environment. At least that's a possibility if we'd had enough of them trained this way, educated in this way.
Well, another thing of difficulty at the time was that you could not get staff. For example, in the science, when I took over the liberal science program, I could not get a man to teach chemistry in general terms. All he did was to have the students read harder, but he had them read in terms of chemistry for engineers, which was, of course, defeated the purpose of the
I always science. Felt that Professor Mark Horowitz in physics was a different, had a somewhat different approach than this, and was maybe a little better in terms of a general appreciation of what was needed.
And then Miss Johnson took it over, and
yes.
She was wonderful. It depended on the personnel. For example, when students have comparative literature with Herbert Muller, it was a wonderful course. But when we had somebody else come in, all they did was to call it liberal science and teach it in a different way.
It had to have experts as teachers, there's no doubt about
and
that.
And we could not get that under Dean Ayers.
Mm-hmm.
It was just impossible. So well, that's, and in other words, I think Dean Ayers talked to his department heads and they could see no use in it.
Well, the theory was, of course, I guess, that the whole school of science would become liberalized.
Yes, with the new curriculum.
The new curriculum.
And that was an ideal.
Yeah. Well, perhaps it was better than the one before. The progress was slow, let's put it that way.
Did you find, because Purdue was oriented to applied subjects, home economics, and to prepare women to be teachers, did you find that in any way that that was a deterrent to your program?
Well, I think the thing that increased the program in and gave us the opportunities that we had in terms of numbers of students was the preparation for secondary teachers was emphasized. And because, of course, now, for the last several years, practically half of all the Purdue women have had teaching majors and have teaching certificates when they finish, which was not the case before.
In other words, the hope to create professional engineers and women who would go on into the law and medicine didn't take hold very well.
No, it did not. And of course this, unfortunately, has been true all over the country as far as engineering is concerned. The number of women engineers is just infinitesimal. But this has been because there hasn't been sufficient encouragement from not only from engineers but from education in general in terms of the counseling that junior high school girls get, for instance. In other words, the counseling they have been getting for a long time has been pretty limited in terms of what girls ought to prepare themselves to do. And there was no, you've heard it yourself, I'm sure, a dozen times. If there were a boy and a girl both in the family, and they were both smart youngsters, and they were both interested in medicine, and the boy was encouraged to be a doctor, and the girl was encouraged to be a nurse.
Well, another thing too, we didn't have courses, unless they were in home ec, in merchandising in the sense, did we? Our home ec majors, how many of them were prepared to be go out into the world of business, merchandising?
Well, I do think this was maybe the one place where they did get preparation for professional work later, out in the world of business and industry, was in home economics, and in the foods and textiles, and nutrition research areas. This, I think, was good.
Well, did you have any other of these general curriculum problems that came over in the course of your 20-some years?
Well, we got feedback from individual women students was the source of our information in terms of what was happening to them academically. And throughout the years, and even yet, even as late as this past year, an outstanding woman in science or mathematics was apt to be encouraged by an academic advisor to get a teacher's license or to develop or to aim at technology rather than graduate work and high-powered graduate work in the field of her choice. In other words, a woman student who had her sights set on being a political scientist, for instance, would find herself being counseled to become a teacher of civics in high school or social science or something of this sort, which would not probably have been the case with a man student of comparable ability.
Yes. Well, I can see that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they had trained women counselors taking these young ladies, there might have been a different point of view, different?
I would hope so. On the other hand, it's only been in relatively recent years that there has been very much national attention to this kind of thing. But within the last 5 years, for instance, the Women's Bureau of the Department of Labor has issued a series of brochures aimed at the junior high and high school girl. Why not be an engineer? Why not be a conservationist? Why not be a pharmacist? Why not be this, that, or the other? To try to broaden the scope of choices that the girl has in high school in terms of what she's willing to prepare herself to do in college. Because unless a girl takes in high school all the hard courses, mathematics and English and science that are offered, she's going to be behind when she gets to college if she wants to go and do anything.
Well, do you think that curriculum in high school is rigged for the more still for the male who's going on to go into business or professions?
Oh, I'm sure it is. I'm sure that the encouragement today to the boys in high school is to take the mathematics and the science, and to the girls is, what do you need it for? In some, I shouldn't say this across the board, but I know there's still a lot of this going on.
Well, let me ask you a question now. Coming back again to Purdue, you were here when there were comparatively few women and under the administration of President Eliot, and then you served entirely, almost entirely, under Mr. Hovde. Would you like to say anything about these two gentlemen and their attitude towards the education of women?
Well, I love them both.
Yes, they were different
They
people.
Were very different people. I'm not sure either one of them was ever convinced that the role of women in society was or could be anything but a supportive role. I don't think either one of them ever expected women to take much leadership, excepting in things perhaps that pertain to women only. I think the kind of university organization that has developed over the country, that developed not only at Purdue, but at practically every other large coeducational institution in the country during the time that Mr. Hovde has been president, has been very interesting. There's been a layer of vice presidents interposed between the president and the deans of the schools and the dean of men and dean of women. In other words, the president, I think, has tried to share this responsibility, which I can understand why he would need to in terms of the size of the operation. But this has had a terrific impact on the education of women, in my opinion, because the number of vice presidents who have been appointed, who have been women, has just been absolutely nil. There's a complete layer of men between any woman administrator, whether it be an academic administrator or a personnel administrator, and the president of the university. Now, this makes it difficult.
You mean that then those who are telling the story from the point of view of women's education find it more difficult to get to the top?
Of course they do. Of course they do.
You find that is it lack of understanding or or does it make for inefficiency in administering programs?
Well, I suspect it's because it would make for inefficiency in administering programs. That efficiency has been the criterion used rather than any particular educational outcome. This is something that is not only true at Purdue, but it's true across the country.
In other words, when you had smaller students, you could go in and talk directly to Elliot, and you found it becoming increasingly more impossible to talk to Hubby.
It wasn't because it was difficult to talk to Mr. Hubby or because he did not maintain an open door policy, but there was a certain path you had to follow, which made it difficult. And I doubt if presidents realize how difficult this is for anyone the other side of the layer, so to speak. Now, it doesn't matter what the attitude is of any individual, either at the vice presidential level or at the presidential level. It's still more difficult. And, of course, in meanwhile, there's been the change in the personnel field of with the increased number of students, of going to a dean of students set up instead of a dean of men, dean of women. Frequently, of course, there's been a dean of students with a dean of men, dean of women, down one more layer, echelon.
That's what we have here, isn't it?
No, it is not. We have never had a dean of students at Purdue.
Well,
the reason we haven't is because we have felt that we needed coordinate offices, dean of men, dean of women. Now we have had a vice president in charge of student services, and we do have now. But we have had coordinate dean of men and dean of women's offices. Even at the time that we had an office called the Office of Student Affairs, the office of the dean of women was not under this office. It still reported directly to the president's office.
Well, that makes it very comfortable, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know whether you're being, I don't know whether you really mean this or not, but it makes it terribly uncomfortable to have an office called the Office of Student Affairs and an Office of Dean of Women.
In which realm was it the most difficult? Was it in administering discipline and just looking after thousands of girls, their housing and social life? Or was it in other fields?
I suppose that the aspect of it that has seemed to me the most difficult is the fact that there were almost no role models of women in relatively important positions in the university that anyone could point to as far as women students were concerned and say, see what she's doing. I mean, she's really making an impact. She's making a contribution to the university. She is loved and respected for her intellectual contribution. They've been pretty scarce.
In other words, well, at Purdue it would be difficult because of our orientation, wouldn't it?
Well, it's doubly difficult at Purdue. But the same thing has been true at every other university that I know anything about. My colleagues the other Big Ten universities, of course, have been through the same thing, even though they're not as oriented quite so much to...
Of course, you know, this is a leading question, and one which I know you'll deal with it at once. So many people think of the Dean of Women as the woman who rides herd on the morals of the girls. They must get them at 8 o'clock at night, and they must have pink tees, and the girls must be taught how to dress, and so on. This concept is outmoded, isn't it? Or hasn't it changed a great deal?
Well, I think this concept is completely outmoded, And I think the only people who perpetuate it are people older than I am, and that's pretty old. So, oh, I'm serious about this. If we didn't have to fight the stereotype that is perpetuated by parents and grandparents, if we had only the idea of the young person to deal with, we'd be in better shape. But as I say, I think that the thing that has not been understood about the Office of Dean of Women is the really consuming interest in the education of women as a total pattern, and not just in the what shall I say, less important aspects of social education.
That is, it is not your job as a dean of women to look after the girls' morals.
Well, I've never thought that I could do too much about it, excepting to try to help create an environment which would encourage relatively good morals, good in quotes.
In terms of the community in which Purdue is situated.
I think we operated at Purdue for a long time on the general basic principle that Purdue students, both men and women, were expected to behave as ladies and gentlemen. Now, unfortunately, in the last few years, there's been a great movement, particularly on the part of students and on the part of a good many professors, faculty people, to try to spell out, and to want spelled out in detail, what acceptable behavior is.
This brings right down to the problem that this is a loaded question, and I want you to answer it, because so many people say that dean of men and dean of women have traditionally in their preparation missed the boat of what concerns today's student. For example, the dean of women in, let's say, a small college says, a nice girl doesn't smoke, and immediately the answer is, well, my mother smokes, I smoke. Do you mean we're not nice?
Well, I think, honestly, I think this is a part of the stereotype. I don't think there are nearly as many deans of women who do this as people would like to blame, shall I say. I really don't.
Well, what has been the change then? If you're not going to, you say conduct of ladies and gentlemen, and you'd rather not have it spelled out. Has this been the concern of the dean of women?
Well, I think the concern of the dean of men, dean of women, both, has been that students, as part of their development and part of their developing education, would learn to manage themselves with a set of ethical standards in relationship to their fellow human beings.
Well, now you see, the students I talked to, I used to be a fraternity advisor, and say, why can't we have beer in the house? And why do they have to send snoopers around, you know, this kind of thing?
Well, of course, the alcoholic beverage question at Purdue has plagued both the students and the personnel offices for a good many years. But I have it myself, and I know why it's...
All right, we're back on the tape now. Let's go on with this that we were discussing. We were talking about, actually, the problems of young men and women living as ladies and gentlemen and not spelling out too much what they must do and must not do.
Well, one thing that is certainly involved in all this is observance of the civil law. I believe firmly that young people need to learn that there are ways of changing laws, and that in a democratic society you work through channels and you work to get a law changed. You don't just ignore it. And this, of course, is where we came into difficulty with the alcoholic beverage law, because Purdue was a state institution, or is a state institution, and I certainly never felt that I could ever do anything excepting support the state law, which I intended to do.
Well, you have to. Of course, there was the attitude that they wouldn't allow liquor here in town. I told my young men in the fraternity that no one's going to interfere with their private life, but they must not, in a sense, they must not put themselves in a position where they're going to get arrested.
Well, I think that's a relatively simple way to put it.
So I said, if you're going to drink, you drink where you're not going to put yourselves or your friends in jeopardy.
Well, and you deal with your own conscience on this matter. If you're not entitled to it because of AIDS, then it's up to you as to how you feel about the law as such. But as for me, I believe in supporting it until you get it changed.
Of course. Now, I noticed that the university used to provide mixers and dances and so forth, the junior prom. Now, that much of that is gone, isn't it?
Practically all of that is gone.
Now, what does the Dean of Women's Office do to take its place?
Well, I think that there isn't anything in terms of other dances or parties or this sort of thing, because students' interests have changed. They've changed both because they have had they've gone through all this in high school these days. I mean, they've had their junior proms, they've had their all-night parties, they've had all this kind of thing in high school, and they're a little bored with it in the first place. In the second place, I think they are far more concerned about social issues and about serious discussion of social issues. And they are interested in small groups and small group emphasis far more than big parties or big anything. And I suppose this is maybe this is partly because institutions have gotten so big. And they feel the need of small group association more than they did
before. Of course, we've got to say something. Let's get it on now. What's the role of the fraternity and the sorority?
I think the role of the fraternity and sorority is still the same as it always has been, in my opinion. Now, I don't know whether this quite agrees with what they have always thought their role was, but I think their role has been to provide relatively small group living of a good sort. And by this I mean with emphasis on the quality of group life rather than on ostentation or on the necessary...
Psychologically hiding behind a Greek letter.
This is right. This is right. And I think the interest of sorority and fraternity women and men has... the interest has changed as much for them as it has for any other segment of student population.
As I see now, the snobbishness of social life is pretty well brought out of the fraternity.
I think it has. I really do.
But the advantage of the fraternity to me is that you get a group of like-minded friends in a large group, and you can live with 40 or 50 men and get to know them. And the fraternity now provides for what the small college said in the past that it used to provide for, that is, you get to know your classmates.
I think this is true, and I would hope that they would become even more of a cross-section of the student population than they are currently, and I think they're headed in that direction.
Well, I think that disposes of that. Now, let me put you on the spot, and you don't have to answer the question if you don't want to. As the numbers grew, did you find the HUBD administration's point of view change in the course of time, and if it did change, under what conditions, and were you responsible for it?
I think you better shut off the tape and let me think that one over.
All right, we'll stop for a moment. All right, we're now back on the tape.
Well, you were asking about the difference in type of administration. Well, as I remember the days before the University Senate organization, there was an executive council or executive committee which was made up of the deans of the schools and the dean of men and dean of women, and I don't know whether there's anybody else, might have been one or two other persons in there, who met every week with the president of the university and talked about overall university problems. Then with the increasing numbers and the increasing load on the president's office, the organization became one where there were several vice presidents. And I think, and then there was the university senate. But this was not the close-knit organization that gave very many people the opportunity to talk about overall university problems or the direction of the university in any sense.
Is this because of the just the bigness of the university?
Well, I'm not sure that necessarily was. I think perhaps it was a matter of choice of type of organization there for a while, and I think probably they still meet as the Dean's Council, or the academic deans, but the Dean of Men and Dean of Women were not included in this, which I think was a serious mistake at the time this was originated, because this really cut in two the university interest and put the academic on one side and the personnel on the other, and the two had no opportunity really, excepting through the vice president in charge of student services, who had a great many responsibilities. And I've always felt this was a very serious mistake, and I think our student descent of the last few years could very well be accounted for in some measure because of this. I'm sure the size had a great deal to do with the choice.
Has this sort of trend developed, in other Big Ten universities and colleges?
Well, I do know that Purdue is the last of the Big Ten universities that has Dean of Men and Dean of Women by name. Now, they have people who do these jobs, but they are organized in many instances along functional lines. Of course, really, what we need is associated deans of students. Now, we need two deans of students. We don't need one dean of students only, but we need, because both the men's personnel office and the women's personnel office deal with both men and women students. This is the real truth of the matter. And you're not going to get a complete point of view on either unless you have both men and women working with it. But this, of course, this doesn't fit into the usual picture of an organization chart that starts with 8 and goes up to 4 to 2 to 1.
I understand. How is it nationally? About the same?
About the same.
Women's colleges, have they changed their function and the role of the Dean of Women very much?
Well, of course, both men's and women's colleges, for the most part, have now gone coeducational.
Vassar's coeducational. Radcliffe, of course, in a sense, always was.
Yale, Princeton, Amherst, all these places.
Is Smith is coeducational with Amherst?
Oh, Smith has lots of various arrangements where they have men on campus and women out on other campuses. I don't know what all the arrangements are specifically. Wellesley is undergoing a very serious study now as to whether or not they should expand their relationships with MIT. They have about 200, I think, MIT men on campus now. And they're wondering whether or not they should expand this kind of relationship with the other men's institutions in the area, or what they should do about it.
Well, the bulk of the crew then might turn out to be 8 men.
I beg pardon?
Wellesley crew might turn out to be 8 men compete in the intercollegiates. Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. Or they might even have a coxswain on the Harvard crew who was a woman.
That's been known to happen.
I think
hope
so.
It doesn't. No, I hope it doesn't. Let's just talk generally. Looking ahead, what will be the role of the dean of women or someone doing the job in the next 20 years in American education, higher education? Is it going to change?
Well, I think the role of a dean of women's office in the future, in the foreseeable future, is probably the emphasis is going to have to be on this general kind of thing, the education of women that I talked about in the beginning.
Yes.
Individual counseling is the heart of the program in terms of actual service to students at this point. Plus, of course, the student organizational advising, which is limited to a few organizations at this point, but it's important if you expect these organizations to be educational, which we've always expected. I think this is the interesting thing that has developed is that the AAUP, for instance, came out with their Committee S report a few years ago, which implied at least, in fact it said in words of one syllable, I guess I should say, that the extra classroom life of students ought to be their own business. That sure, it was educational, but they didn't need any teachers or supervisors or advisors or anything else in this. They needed, of course, instructors, professors in the classroom, but outside the classroom, they didn't need anybody. They should be left to their own devices. Well, of course, this is entirely different from a personnel point of view. As personnel people, we have always believed that there was a lot of education that took place outside the classroom, which I think the AAUP goes along with. But we have felt that there needed to be some direction to this education outside the classroom as much as direction within the classroom. And we've considered ourselves educators. And I think the educational thrust of personnel office is more complete than just one or the other.
Well, the trend may be then, do you think the trend may be towards providing advice and counseling on careers and opportunities and so on?
I think this is always involved and has been always involved in spite of academic counseling within the various schools. Because in many instances, the academic counseling within the schools have been, this counseling has been related to the selection of courses and this sort of thing, which is certainly appropriate, it must be. But in terms of general life planning, I think this comes back then very often into the personnel offices.
Well, if you're going to do this, then you're going to have women who say, look, here's the field of accountancy, or of advanced research in physics, and be able to talk pretty intelligently about it.
This is right, and it's going to be important to have counselors in the high schools and junior high schools who also have a pretty broad concept of what the opportunities for women today really are. In other words, they've got to begin to broaden the aspirations of youngsters, of women.
And it's got to start in the high schools.
I think so, at least there.
Well, then it means from high school through their university, these services ought to be, in a sense, coordinated. Does it mean training, a difference in training and staffs of dean of women's offices?
Well, I think I think perhaps it means more emphasis toward this, in this direction. Of course, I don't know. Well, I think all personnel training, graduate schools now that are doing personnel training, I believe are all coeducational, as far as I know. And it means an emphasis across the board to both men and women counselors and personnel administrators of the changing life patterns of women in the United States so that they will be prepared to counsel girls in the right direction.
Was there anything more you want to talk on this? We're not through our interview, but while we're on the trend of thought, would you like to, do you have some opinions you'd like to put on?
Well, I think that the thing that would help a dean of women's office get across the point that life patterns for women in the United States have changed and that women students need to anticipate working outside their homes and they need to know that they're probably going to want to when the children are in school and they have time. The thing that would help the most would be if there were a few more women scattered through the university community as full professors, as heads of academic departments, as vice presidents, an occasional president perhaps of a coeducational institution, this kind of thing, where there be some honest-to-goodness role models in the educational setting itself that women students could see and that men students could see. This would help the most.
Now, in the course of your career, you've done some publications, and I hope that we will have in the appendix, when it is finally typed up, a list of your publications and major addresses. You've published two or three books, haven't you, on the problem of counseling and what to expect out of college?
No, as a matter of fact, I haven't.
I thought you had one called Best Foot Forward.
Well, this was purely a social usage guide for young people where Dorothy Stratton and I believed that there ought to be something written that was more relevant and useful to young people than an Emily Post, we'll say. So we collected questions from students themselves all over the country that they really would like to have answered, and we tried to answer it in cooperation with student leaders again as to what they considered acceptable practice on their campuses. But this was definitely a social usage guide, hopefully with ethical training implications along the side.
Yes.
And then the other book that was the group golf instruction. Since these two publications, I have done a great many articles of one kind or another that have appeared in
the... Well, we will have a list of those, I hope, in the appendix.
Journal. It's been on housing and student personnel problems, but I have not done a book.
Those problems, of course, have changed, haven't they, over the last 20 years? That is, housing, putting people together, and so on.
Well, I think
the fundamentals are the same.
The thing that has happened in residence hall administration across the country again, not only at Purdue, but across the country, has been the centering of responsibility for university operated residence halls, centering the responsibility in the business office, and have taken it out of the hands of the personnel people in any way.
This has been, wasn't Purdue rather a pioneer in this?
Well, this happened very soon after the war, and yes, I think it was a pioneer in this, and I consider this one of the things that has made student life administration relatively difficult.
You will find others that don't share that opinion.
I don't doubt this either. But the relationships at Purdue have been between the personnel offices and the residence halls have been good purely because of the goodwill of the people involved, not because there's any organizational responsibility back and forth.
That is an interesting comment. You mean had they left the administration of the halls to the personnel, it might have been organizational, from the point of view of organization, easier?
Yes, I think so. And I think the original organization of the women's halls, where the director of the halls was directly responsible to the business office for the business management of the halls and responsible to the Dean of Women for the personnel programs, the educational and social programs of the halls, I know could work because I made it work.
On a national level, would you like to compare your operation with that of anybody else? You know, I was at Ohio University for 3 years, and I remember you always said such nice things about Dean Irma Voigt, for example, who was a great dean of women in her right after World War I. Would you like to make any comparisons of what you have emphasized here as compared with others?
Well, I think the emphasis has changed since the mid-40s to the 70s across the country. It certainly has changed from the feeling of responsibility for social education and from the only, shall we say, to, I think it's a broader concept than it was. I think the time when women like Irma Voigt at Ohio University and Alice Floyd at the University of Michigan and Sarah Blanding at the University of Kentucky, those were the days when the Dean of Women was sitting in direct contact with the president of the university on an executive council which was making policy. And I think things are quite different now. Not only at Purdue, but all other places.
In other words, the Dean of Women has less to say about her policy for her job than she had before.
Well, she has less to say about the policy for her job, but far more important to me is that she has no voice in the overall university administration.
Was this the sort of thing you would favor of women's liberation movement? Is the liberation movement correct in emphasizing that women are being discriminated against in their jobs?
Well, it is interesting that WEAL, W-E-A-L, which is the Women's Equity Action League, is made up largely of lawyers and professional women, and currently, they have cited under the compliance requirements of the federal government over 100 universities that do discriminate against women in their opinion, and the Justice Department is very much interested in these cases.
Are we one?
No, not yet. No.
We are not one-sided. Well, is there anything more we ought to put on? Before we go off, I'd like to have you discuss, if you would care to, any of your staff and the people with whom you work in the Dean of Women's office that you'd like to talk about.
Well, I, of course, have always taken great pride in the staff of the Office of the Dean of Women. I think they've been the finest staff of any Office of the Dean of Women any place in the country, and I think there are plenty of other people who think that too. I'm delighted that Beverly Stone is the current Dean of Women. I think both associate deans, Dean Cecilia Zissis and Dean Barbara Cook, are both wonderful people and wonderful in the personnel field. I think there's no better organizer or keeper track of details in the world than Celie Zissis. And I don't know of anybody on the on the whole campus that has better rapport with students than Barb Cook. And this includes what a lot of people call the dissident students. And this is good to have someone who really has been able to establish rapport with all categories of students. And I don't know of anyone who has ever had better relationships with students, both men and women students, than Bev Stone. I don't know of anyone who gets more letters back from graduates as when graduates come back from homecoming, they flock out to the Stone Cook house. I know this. I think this is wonderful. Of course, there are several other people on the staff who all have their individual strengths. They're good with the test interpretation and the individual counseling, and they are good working with the married student council in the housing area. They're good working with the cooperative houses, and they're working with the sorority houses, working with the student organization in the women's halls and this kind of thing. They're really a wonderful group of women.
Well, all right. Now, is there something we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about?
Goodness, seems to me we've talked about everything. I don't think of anything else.
Well, all right then. Now remember, we can come back and have another interview if you should like. But then for this time, this is the end of the interview between Dean Helen Schliemann, Dean of Women at Purdue University, and R.B. Eccles of the Department of History for the use of the Purdue University Archives.